You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As many of us may be reminded at some point during our Thanksgiving dinners, getting a word in edgewise when someone insists on dominating the conversation can be difficult. In the Broadway revival of La Bête, it's virtually impossible. At the center of the play is a 25-minute discourse on matters big and small delivered in rhyming verse by a street performer named Valère. But the play also explores the tension between popular art and high art. It's playing at the Music Box Theater through January 9th, and I'm very pleased to welcome all three of the production stars to our show today. Mark Rylance, who plays Valère, David Hyde Pierce, who plays his victim, and Joanna Lumley, who plays his patron. Welcome.
Thank you.
And thanks, welcome Leonard. Back, and David and Mark. Mark, a lot of adjectives have been used by critics and writers to describe Valère. How would you describe him?
Oh, he's just that that part of us that's desperate to be loved, desperate to be included. He's on the outside, but has a certain social habit of talking without stopping and without listening that makes it difficult for him to achieve what he wants.
Well, all the time that he's proclaiming just how humble he is, he lets us know that he thinks he's a genius.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's actually described as a discourse or a monologue, but it's really a duologue in that all the things he says comes off of David's attempts as Elamir to get him to leave the room or to admit something that is a lie. It's really a duologue in my mind between the two of us. I just happen to dominate everything that comes into your mind that you want to say, don't I?
Yeah, it's. I think audiences identify because we've all been in the situation when you're with someone who talks endlessly and all the different things that go through your mind of first maybe being amused and then thinking, well, this is going to end sometime and then thinking this may never end and then getting angry and then leaving and coming. All that stuff, it's not that far from all of our personal experience, I think.
And although you don't get to say many words, you're there constantly reacting.
Yes.
It's a kind of a physical dialogue in your case.
One of my favorite comments I got from an audience member afterwards, she said, I loved all the faces that you made to draw attention to yourself.
Well, Elamir, your character is an actor and a playwright, and as many have pointed out, his name is an anagram for Molière. He's relying on the princess's appointment. That would be very important for him and his company.
Well, yeah, Joanna plays this patron of the arts who a year ago brought me and my wandering troupe of actors under her wing and took care of us and for a year has fed us and clothed us, you know, to the nines and been our supporter. And the conflict of the play for me at this point is suddenly a year into our tenure, she's brought in this new guy played by Mark.
You, Joanna, play the princess who spotted Valère performing on the street. She thinks it would help liven up Elamir's company.
Yes. I think that Elamir suddenly started to, he's becoming a bit too clever, she thinks, for his own boots.
A little dull.
A little sort of drab. He's now his work isn't rhyming, and she's passionate about rhyming things. She's not the brightest, she's not the sharpest knife in the box, but she has got the power. And she's spotted this street clown who enchanted her, as indeed he enchants the audience, begins to enchant everybody.
Well, I've...
Begins, I say, to enchant. And just thinks that he's so lively and so different that if he and Elamir were to work together, that's all she really wants, is for them to rub along together.
But also I've known a number of patrons who felt that their money was best spent if they were doing something cutting edge. And he represents... He may be a street performer, but he represents cutting edge to her, and this would be something exciting and avant-garde.
Yes, she says she loves dramatic innovation, so she loves things that tip everything on its head a bit. She's excited by chaos in a way, and so this seems just the boy. She doesn't want to lose Elamir, but Elamir comes out very strongly and says it's either him or me.
Do you think Elamir has gotten complacent with his royal appointment?
From my own perspective, no. I think what's happened is he's started to explore new areas and that his work has started to go into more things that aren't as accessible or readily accessible to people.
There's a phase, isn't there, in any rehearsal of one production or in the life of a company. I mean, in England, I'm much more aware of subsidized companies who have lives like the Berlin Ensemble did or that.
But you've run your own company.
And I've run my own, though that was not subsidized. The Globe was, completely commercial company. But there's a phase where the work goes into a kind of chaotic area. If anyone gardens, they know that phase. It's a very important phase where everything has to rot and die for new stuff to come. And the constant pressure to be commercial can make people try and nip and tuck and get rid of that phase. And Elmer, I agree with you. I think he's just going through a phase, and the princess makes a mistake. I think the much more cutting-edge person who in a year or so is going to have fantastic new work that's going to be amazing is Elmer. And she goes for the easy, flashy option.
But I wondered whether Elmer doesn't believe in his talents a bit too much. It's clear that he thinks of himself as a great artist in much the same way that Valère thinks of himself as a great artist. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the playwright David Herson has said that one of the things he presents to audiences is not an easy reconciliation of these two things. He presents the extremes, mm-hmm. the extreme of sort of low vulgarity and the extreme of high-mindedness. And, of course, what he actually achieves is giving you the synthesis that the characters never get because he gives you both things in the same play.
Mm. There was a lot of discussion before we came to New York about changing the title. The Lebette is a bit obscure for some people and makes it sound like a Molière play.
But it is a revival. That's like saying, let's change Hamlet to something like What's Happening in Denmark.
Well, I guess so. I think the title, not to David Herson, I do Hamlet here. Well, he's written a very wonderful play. I think the title can put people off or make people not sure what it's about. And in those discussions, anyway, the title of the Ass or the Fool or the Beast came up. But the one David also put forward was the Egotist. Hmm. And he wanted the audience, and he said, really, they should not know which of the three of them the title is referring to. Because even the patron, it's apparent, has a lot of ego in her place between contending artists.
Well, what about for actors, Joanna? Is the whole matter of high art versus appealing to the lowest common denominator something that actors have to consider? Or do you just take the job because want to work?
I come from pretty much street level, gutter level, so I'm sort of very grateful for anything that comes my way. But I'm sure that people do see things as high and low art. And some people are quite, some actors I know are very selective. I have a very loosely woven net to let things in. I do virtually anything that lands on the doorstep.
Well, it must have helped that Absolutely Fabulous was more than a couple of cuts above the usual sitcom, and so was Frasier, David. So you didn't have to apologize for being in something.
No, that was great. True. I mean, that was the highest form of satire. It was really completely brilliant, and so you could play this sort of white trash very happily. But a lot of jobs you get offered aren't really up to scratch. But if you didn't do some pretty bad jobs, you'd be out of work a lot of the time. I quite like doing bad jobs.
Do you learn from the bad jobs?
Yeah, you make friends too, and also you get very good stories to tell afterwards.
Well, some artists and writers have been able to include elements of both high and low art. Mark, William Shakespeare's plays come to mind. Is he an exception to the general rule in that he somehow is able to pull it off?
I think of the playwrights of his period, he does it. He's remarkable. Yes, I think you're right. I think there's a time before the Civil War. There's a 40 or 50 year period where all the things that the street performers had learned playing in market squares and in pubs and very public places, a bit like Valère type characters, all the Kemps and Burbages and all these people had really had to survive in a very rough way, taking whatever they could. That for a little period met with this the Renaissance of learning and understanding of deeper psychological truths. And so that did last for a while, and then the Puritans really came in, eventually closed it down and separated those things again. But there was a great flowering there, as there was in each of the countries in the Renaissance, of very subtle consciousness and very rough consciousness, making friends and marrying. And I think that's true probably of most great works of art that have endured.
Of course, theater flourished after the Puritans lost power in England.
It had lost its lost its legs, though, and
well, it became more vulgar, didn't it? It really
And vain and shallow and I mean, we're still in a process of returning Shakespeare to get closer. We're still in England, at least, trying to cut away Victorian principles of how it should be played, and it's a constant piece of work to get back to the original.
David, do you think that Elamere's inability to react forcefully to Valère's long-winded speech or even get a word in edgewise is meant to parallel high art's attempt to answer popular art? Does popular art kind of filibuster the way that Valère does?
Leonard, I think one of the things that happens in the play, and it especially happens as we performed it here, is that it isn't just the issue of high and low art that comes up. It also has more to do or as much to do with the issue of saying something and saying nothing. Mm-hmm. And we feel very strongly in the audience, political resonance that happens, including very vocal responses from the audience sometimes, as you hear this fantastic both performance and fantastic writing of this speech, where a man literally spends 30 minutes never actually saying
anything.
And you have another character who ultimately
– but very amusingly.
Of course, and entertainingly and brilliantly. And I think Elamere's sort of – voice in this is just to say to be someone to speak up for content.
The whole thing, we should point out again, is entirely in rhyming couplets, although at times we in the audience forget that or overlook it. I'm assuming that that's something that was worked out during rehearsals, or is that an aspect of the script?
I think, well, David and Mark are princes at this, but the way I think of speaking, particularly rhyming verse, is to make it as accessible as possible. And the way David Hurston has written this, it quite often sentences finish in the middle of a line, and so it's all automatically broken up. And you don't, some of them you can hear, which is a felicity. It's lovely to hear them. And sometimes you think maybe they've broken out and they're now speaking in blank verse, and they're not. It's absolutely rigorously done in iambic pentameter and rhyming couplets. Absolutely staggering achievement as far as a 27-year-old, because he was only 27 when he wrote this play. Absolutely astonishing, I think.
What about acting it? Because you both want us to know that there's a rhyme, and at the same time, you don't want the rhyme to dominate.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I do my best. Mark, on the other hand, looks as though he's been searching about in a hay loft and has scratched some things up. He doesn't sound... Anything he says has actually been written down at all, let alone in rhyming couplets.
Yeah, and Mark has talked about his love of improv.
It's extraordinary genius. But it isn't, because when you look at the book, if you had the book on your lap, he's saying everything that was there. So that there are different levels. But I think also his chaotic approach to the text is very well reflected by the more orderly state, the court of the princess's court, where we actually are a more ordered and maybe a more high-minded group of people. And the princess may be the poshest of the lot, which is why she speaks with an English accent, to define her from the rest of the courtiers, or rather the troop of players.
I was going to say also that our director, Matthew Warchus, was very sensitive to the verse of the play and sensitive to finding places to underscore it, sometimes with music, sometimes subtly emphasizing the rhythm of it, and finding other times where all of us who were in normal conversation would make it evaporate so that it just was something that would sort of rise and fall during the evening.
Do these rhyming couplets make it easier to memorize, like Shakespeare's meter?
They make it easier to know when you're wrong, and it's easier for the audience to know when you're wrong.
Because you've suddenly said something that you can't rhyme.
But
has that happened a lot?
Yeah, I forget my lines sometimes.
Very.
Yeah.
Well, you have a lot of lines to remember, and although actors do remember their lines, amateurs are always shocked at how well actors can memorize. But and that's part of your job. But still, something like this has to be daunting.
Oh no, it's really fun. I see. To me, it's a burlesque play. To me, I saw an old Dick Cavett interview with Groucho Marx the other night. I've been going through the Dick Cavett interviews. And he got up and sang Lydia. And the delightful rhymes in that song. And to me, it goes back to Mark Twain and the whole tradition in America of if you're going to make fun of, satirize a particular American thing, set it in a European court, and give it some highfalutin language, and then we'll have a delight at the way that it rhymes, because the rhymes, it's not got any complicated language in it. It's very colloquial American, set in Paris. So when we were in London, I felt there was a little bit of a distance. London audiences, why are they all speaking in American accents apart from the princess, you know? But coming here, it really feels like such a burlesque New York play.
Do you ever have to come up with rhymes to cover up the fact that you've forgotten a line?
No, I'm hopeless.
He doesn't forget things.
My guests are Mark Rylance, David Hyde Pierce, and Joanna Lumley. They are starring in La Bête at the Music Box Theater on West 45th Street, and it's running, unfortunately, only until January 9th. We have a link for ticket information on our show page at WNYC.org, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Joanna Lumley, David Hyde Pierce, and Mark Rylance, the stars of La Bête, now at the Music Box Theater on West 45th Street, running through January 9th. We mentioned that this is a revival. When it opened in New York in what year?
91.
It bombed. Now, Mark, you were in Boeing, the revival of Boeing. Also with this director, Matthew Marchis.
And that also bombed.
That had bombed
that
the first time it was in New York, too.
Is it
that we didn't see it, or that we didn't see their value in the first productions, or have they been adjusted so much that we are seeing a very different kind of play in each case?
Oh, no, there are very specific reasons why. I think some plays bomb and nothing, no one remembers it. When La Bête bombed, there was such an outcry from Tony Kushner and Hal Prince and a number of different people that this play was treated very, very unfairly, and this very ambitious and witty writer had been completely badly treated.
Do people not get that it was very funny?
Oh, yeah, they did get it funny. No, the problem is very specific. The problem is that the actor, bless him, who was playing my part, had to step down in previews in Boston, and he came down and revealed to the critic how unhappy he was, and that influenced the critic.
Wow. Well, you said that when you first read this play, you didn't get it.
I did get it. I did. Certainly, I got it. I thought the ambition of what he was trying to do at the end of the play needed some work. And I think my imagination of what happened the first time was that if you had someone who was having trouble playing Valère, you would have spent the whole rehearsal period working with that person and not been able to actually deal with the structural. Always with a new play, there are structural things. And what Matthew's had time this time to do is to condense the play. So we've cut about 45 minutes of it and let it go right the way through. So you really benefit from that magical thing of verse. Being like a song and having a rhythm.
No intermission.
No intermission, right? The way 145. So it the suspense of it, what happens in it is, whereas before it was two hour halves, yeah. I think. So it was a much wider play at that time.
Another change is that the prince has become a princess.
Yes.
And it really does affect our perception of this play. Your character is just wonderful, Joanna.
Well, being her, I can't now imagine how. I would love to see the play with it as a prince, because I feel in my bones that this is much better as a princess. It makes the dynamic much stronger between these two warring men, because it adds a different element, which is a woman's favour, because she's obviously terribly attracted and very proud of them both and thinks they're both wonderful. But she's vain and determined that she should make them be friends, really, and it's not going to work. And I think that probably works better coming from a woman, her quixotic and a capricious nature.
And I think it also works just like in a piece of chamber music, that having that actual different voice, having a woman's voice in this largely male company is also extremely useful, just as a, you know, brings
the only
a
other
color.
Woman in the cast doesn't talk.
Well, there are a few other women in the cast, but in terms of the principal arguments of the play, there are, yes, that's right. Doreen says one word at a time.
The costumes were designed by Mark Thompson, who also designed the wonderful sets. How important were they in helping you construct the characters in your performances?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, your character, we see his roots in his dyed hair. I mean, there are all sorts of little jokes just in the clothing you're wearing, each of you are wearing.
There's certainly a clear distinction between those actors who are subsidized company members within the princess's troupe, so to speak, and my look, which looks a bit kind of like a, you know, a Rasta man come off the street. And with, you know, I've got severe financial problems.
Well, but Elamir career. Looks almost like a pilgrim. He's dressed in a very austere manner.
Yeah.
The contrast is quite obvious.
You should also talk about, because Joanna's look has changed so much since the beginning, but I think one of the most important things for me about the design, both of the set and the costumes, is that there is a gravitas, a kind of depth and richness to it. And the play, which is hysterically funny, but it also goes to more serious places. And I think subtly, by giving you a context which is so visually rich, it allows for the play to make that journey and for you not as an audience to think, wait a minute, we were funny before, how come we're serious now?
I mentioned earlier, Mark, that there was a recent article in the New York Times which described your love of improv. And you pointed out that you can't really do that with rhyming couplets. But
I do know people who can. There's some kids from Liverpool who came down to the Globe when I was there. Do you know this? And they could improvise a sonnet on any subject.
My God.
And first of all, there would be four of them. So the A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G structure of a sonnet would be shared by someone would be each of those letters. And then they would come down and come down and come down until one person, without pausing and without any unnatural hesitation, someone would say a sonnet on an eggshell, and he would improvise a sonnet. Incredible skills.
Wow.
In a kind of Shakespearean vocabulary, or like David's, like in a more contemporary?
Like Wordsworth or what?
I think on that occasion he would do it in a Shakespearean thing, because it was on the Globe stage, and it was a kind of competition who could – we were competing. So some people can do it in improv. It's amazing what people can do.
But I was interested in the way that – all of you interact. I was wondering if there was any improvisation in the way that you hit a lot of sight gags during at least the rehearsal process.
Totally improvisational for me. Yeah, I don't learn things. I mean, it was interesting because you did have time and you learned before. I was very busy before we began rehearsal and didn't learn any of it. So we made up a lot of it.
We did, but for the same reasons, which is I learned the script so I could be free with it. And Mark didn't learn the script, so he could be free with it.
Right? Yeah.
And Joe, I don't know how you...
I take drugs.
That helps. Well, it's working.
I know. I saw AbFab. I see. I saw too many AbFabs.
Oh, not possible.
Was that improvised a lot?
AbFab, not at all. Right?
Really?
No. Well,
there is such a sense of freedom.
Well, the improvisational nature of it came during rehearsals. So we departed from the text a lot and did a lot of stuff. But once, of course, you know when you're working with cameras, you can't really... You can't risk it.
But you wrote it down at the very last moment, didn't you?
Yes, or stitched it into our heads at the very last moment. It was a lot of it was made up, and a lot of Patsy, as you would say, contributed.
We mentioned earlier that your costume changed has changed.
Well, this is extraordinary. I don't know what there was a sort of idea because this play is set at bang in the middle of the night, which is actually referred to. People think this is midnight. We can't do all this. This thing at midnight, the idea that she now wants this street performer who's been entertained at dinner, or rather has sort of squashed the dinner flat by sort of dominating it. And now she wants him to do plays and I don't know. And it's the middle of the night. And the idea that the princess had actually gone to bed, set up the meal, gone to bed, couldn't resist it and came downstairs. So I've been in everything in sort of hair in ribbons and barefoot and in kind of pajama bottoms and so on, through to every kind of thing. But when I hit New York, I think I hit my stride because I have a vast cannonade of golden confetti races onto the stage ahead of me. And I'm dressed up like a Christmas tree with a censer set in my wig, which attracts a follow spot to me wherever I go. These things are now written into my future contracts.
So anything you do in the future, you want to be preceded by a lot of golden graffiti. Golden confetti. Graffiti as well.
Yeah.
And you must wear a tiara at least, a sparkling tiara and all. My guests are Joanna Lumley, David Hyde Pierce, and Mark Rylance, starring in La Bête, only through January 9th. Is that because you all have other things to do?
Of course.
Well, you have another thing to do. You have another thing coming up.
Oh, later on, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think they. I think it's possible it might go on beyond that, but they, that they want to really, you know, encourage people to come over the holiday period. Mm-hmm. And
it's funny that it's had such a sort of flexible feeling to it because we've played 2.5 months in London. When I first accepted this fabulous job, which took me half a nanosecond, hearing of David and Mark's commitment to it, and also having read the play and knowing Matthew Warchus. And they said, you can be home by Christmas. And I thought, well, this is everything on a stick altogether. I get everything you get from New York and home by Christmas. And then they said, sorry, did we say Christmas? We meant the beginning of January. Sorry, did we say the beginning of January? We meant the middle of January. We meant the end of January. We meant the beginning of February. And eventually I said, just draw a line somewhere. So a line has been drawn, actually, eventually. All of us, because nature abhors a vacuum, will morph into other jobs. And if it had gone on till July, we'd have morphed into other jobs. And if it ended tonight, we would morph into other jobs.
Well, this is your first appearance on Broadway stage.
God, it's fantastic.
Mark has been here many times because David has. Is it very different than the West End?
I tell you what's different. There's a kind of extraordinary energy in this city, which I find comes out of everywhere. There's a friendliness, a vigor, an anxiety to make things work. I find the city, since I first came here 35 years ago, to have changed itself completely. There's no litter in the street. The subways are a pleasure to travel on. People are so friendly and helpful. It's a very safe city to walk in at any hour of the day or night. It's a clean city. And London is lagged behind here, where it's got a kind of strange, tatty, ragged feeling to London, which I don't mind, but it's very different from New York. And this reflects in the audiences who are here determined to have a good time, generous with their applause, vociferous in their reception. Mm. And I find it just a thrilling place to play.
Mm. You're nodding your head, Mark.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that.
No, does that apply to a play like this or anything? I mean, do you find that Americans respond differently to Shakespeare?
Yes, they do respond differently to Shakespeare. Yeah, that's a big topic. Why that happens, and I'm just thinking also that New York's a very wide place, isn't it? We're in this Manhattan part of it, and I'm thinking of playing at St. Anne's and Brooklyn, and that's a whole other city in itself.
And then BAM is another
Queens
experience.
And BAM, and how wide it is. But there is a. You know, I was struck with the last time I was doing Boing Boing was that so much of the roots of the theater is the Yiddish theater too, and the idea of in the Yiddish theater that the theater must connect with its community, it must tell stories that relate to the community, and so the birth of American naturalism came out of that movement, I think, and so an audience comes, you know, they come prepared to match themselves to the play. They're not in awe. I feel they come and they match themselves to the play. What does that have to say to me? And if it says something funny, I'll laugh. And if it says something I don't agree with, I'll boo. And if it says something I do agree with, as David does often at the end of his speech, particularly since this election and just the amount of talking that goes on and people saying they're going to do something and not doing it, that there's kind of individuals are happy to applaud here, which is really nice. There's
Although
a conversation.
A lot of British actors have complained that American audiences applaud when the star comes out and it kind of breaks the
please, honestly, we get that in Britain all the time, particularly on tour, particularly on Wednesday matinees. As soon as the star comes onto stage, no matter what it is, they could come on holding their head with bleeding eye sockets and they would get a round of applause because it's how you greet a star. I can't find that offensive. I can't find it offensive. Also, we've all got a bit prissy about how performers are because, as Mark knows very well, and he's the sort of protagonist of all this, which is that audiences are a very living part of the performance. Mm. And if they feel like shouting or yelling or throwing tomatoes in the old days, that's part of it. You know, we're not special people. We're actors. This show, actually, this play shows that very clearly. Our actors are pretty much the ragbag of society. And if you don't like them, they move on. It's the same with us today. Mm.
David, you'll be performing the part of Scrooge in a reading of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, featuring many of the hosts, including me, from WNYC and WQXR.
Yes,
on Thursday, December 9th.
Yes, that's right.
Are you already feverishly memorizing your lines?
I am, no. But I'll be trying to work up to the level of my co-stars and hoping that I can keep my head above water.
You're in this, aren't you, Leonard?
I am. I think I have a very small part. Mark, you're planning to return to Broadway next year in the Broadway Transfer of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
You won an Olivier for that in London?
I think so.
He did.
And so
he did, and he deserved it.
Are you doing mostly theater these days?
Yeah. Yeah, I love the theater, yeah. Yeah.
And Joanna, you're probably best known in this country for your role as Patsy Stone in Absolutely Fabulous, a character's grasp on reality isn't always that firm. Do you enjoy being closely associated with a character like that?
I love
or
it.
Is it more in this country that in England, do they also think of you as Patsy?
Yes, they do, but I've been around for so long. I'm so old that in England they remember me from 1,000 things anyway, so they call me Joanna there, whereas here they might call me Patsy, which I love. I love being remembered for
Do anything. They actually say hi, Patsy?
Sometimes, yeah. Actually, they're very courteous. They say, hello, Miss Lumley. Hello, Patsy.
More people go up and thank her for what she's done for the Gurkhas, and she's a national treasure in England, Joanna. Yeah, Mark. She's tireless in her defense of people who need defending.
But the great excitement is next year we will have been 20 years. It's the 20th anniversary of Absolutely Fabulous. And so Jennifer Saunders, who's very difficult to tempt out of her ivory tower, is actually going to write a special, I think, so that the old girls can get back again.
I'm curious to see what her daughter has
Safi,
turned into.
Honestly, she's probably grown a beard by now.
Well, she'd become a Gurkha. David, do people still think of you as Niles Crane?
They do occasionally still, although I'm wearing a beard now for this play, and that helps a lot to distinguish me from Niles. And also the fact that I have aged so horribly beyond the preserved record of reruns. But yeah, I still get that. And I like Joanna, I'm very proud of the show and don't mind at all being called Niles.
Well, it's not the worst thing in the world to be associated with a great hit.
No.
And this is a big hit right now. And congratulations and my great thanks to you for coming by and talking about it. David Hyde Pierce, Joanna Lumley, Mark Rylance, they're in La Bette. Currently at the Music Box Theater on West 45th Street, a wonderful theater, and it's running through January 9th. We have a link for ticket information on our show page at wnyc.org.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thanks so much.